This is an adult podcast made by adults for adults. Imagine if Suede and Walter got a guest with a wealth of knowledge and had to try and talk about smart stuff for an hour? Well, the results are predictably disastrous. Enjoy this episode of Fake Film Fans.
Hey everybody, welcome to Fake Film Fans. I'm Suede Best, your zombie boob inspector.
I'm Walter. I'll be one of the history teachers, except I'm from the future, baby! Pew, 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 pew! Matrix.
And I am Mr. No Gimmicks Needed, Austin Slough.
Before we start, just want to quickly thank everyone who's listening again, and the best way to support us is to give us 5 stars or a review wherever you are listening to this podcast.
So petty and so needy. What's wrong with you?
Do you want to do this same joke each fucking time?
I don't know what other joke to do! I'm sorry, I'm a one-trick pony!
Leave me in my wretched little goblin cave.
Yeah, exactly! I'm here in my goblin cave enjoying things!
I don't want success, I want to suffer like a true artist.
So Slough and I, we met working at the AMC movie theater that I talked a little bit about on the podcast.
Yes, we did.
Slough was one of the first not terrible people at the theater. Out of everyone who worked there, it's only two, really, that are... Well, that's not true. There were some other people that were okay, but Slough's the only one I keep in contact with.
There are so many legendary figures from the theater. There's a particular individual that we call Anime X.
Oh yeah, Anime Oscar, yes, is a good way to refer to him. Anime, I once watched that motherfucker eat an entire rotisserie chicken with his hands in the span of about 10 minutes.
It would be so impressive if he just wasn't so, like, repulsive in terms of his personality.
Yeah, I agree. To be fair, though, after he did that, he did spend, like, a solid half hour in the bathroom when he should have been, like, running popcorn and stuff. So,
bro, like, same though. Got that IBS lifestyle, you know?
Yeah, but if you have IBS, you don't get to eat a whole turkey at work.
Oh, no. It's horrific, but like.
Yeah. So part of the reason we got you on here is because we were hanging out and you were furious at Walter and I for our lack of knowledge of Dwight Eisenhower. I've still done no research. I did, however, do a quick Google search and have used the little bit of information I know about Dwight Eisenhower to sell Dwight Eisenhower books at the bookstore.
Okay.
I'm like, yeah, this is a really interesting take, you know, but, you know, it's very interesting, you know, like looking at this versus like, you know, the way people in mainland China see Dwight Eisenhower. I have no clue what I'm talking about, but it does sell.
Why is mainland China an attractive thing for a little person in Roanoke?
It just makes them seem erudite. They can read it and say, well, this is an interesting take, but...
I can actually answer that as someone who has a lot of interest in Chinese history. I think what it really comes from is, like, you know, a lot of people here in the West, we have a very, very invested look into, like, Rome and, like, the history of Europe. China is to Rome what it is to Europe, if that makes sense. You know, China has always been around. It has influenced literally everything around it. China's got wonderful, beautiful history. Why does anyone get into anything with history? You like it.
That's fair. It sounds like everyone in Roanoke is just a little history buff, except Suede.
There are a lot of history buffs. Dude, so many old people come into the store looking for history books. It's like an onslaught, and it's always like presidents or war. It's never like we had this great book about chefs, a history of chefs, like illegally selling LSD, and it took so long for that book to sell. And I was like, this is the history book I would be reading. Like, this sounds fucking phenomenal.
With Americans, the trick is you gotta sell it to them like a cult of personality. You gotta build up the individual and make them, like, hero worship them. Tying back to Dwight Eisenhower, you know why people love him? Because he was a general during WW2, baby.
Baby!
Yeah, like, you know, him and Tricky Dicky were running office, and I love Ike buttons everywhere. I mean, Patton was what every conservative wished they could be appearance-wise. I think he had a little bit more character than most modern ones.
I was mostly curious, Slough, if you had any insight as to why the Chinese population would be down with Dwight Eisenhower when the West is so anti-Dwight Eisenhower because of his whole Vietnam thing.
Also, we should clarify, it's not all Chinese people, it's just the boomer generation of the Chinese people, right? You're not going to find Hu Jintao celebrating Dwight Eisenhower right now.
When you say boomer generation, Walt, were these people who were living through Mao's regime?
Let's not say mainland China. Let's just say Hong Kong.
Okay. Well,
we're and
okay.
It might just be Hong Kong rich people.
Okay.
There might be a lot of layers.
I know that Dwight Eisenhower was definitely a little aggressive in terms of his foreign policy. Honestly, it might be a lot of rub off. Like, his vice president was Richard Nixon and ping pong diplomacy and all that. I can't honestly say, like, why. If there is a small group of older Chinese people who love him, I don't know why.
We'll have to get your grandma on the podcast. If I remember interacting with her correctly, she doesn't speak great English.
So her English level is where if an American says, "You speak pretty good English," it means your English is pretty shit.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of people who grew up not speaking English. It's not just Chinese.
Yes, it is actually the worst insult. Never tell a fucking person you speak very good English and don't do an accent with it. You speak very good English.
I've actually started relearning Spanish a little bit because there's this woman who comes in with her daughter. She speaks English, but her husband speaks Spanish. So that she like almost exclusively speaks to this kid in Spanish when they're in public. I'm not sure why, but like I like it when kids come to the store because like their parents spend money, and like also they're like fun at like talk to and stuff because they like say wild shit. And so I've been like speaking to this kid in Spanish, and I'm like slowly remembering my high school Spanish every time she comes in, and I'm like, hey, and it's still bad. It's terrible Spanish. ¿Te quieres los libros?
You speak really good Spanish, Suede.
Un poquito. Mi español es muy malo. Muy malo, mi español. But so, she is very cute. The mom, I mean, the kid's cute too, but the mom is...
Wait, so this is a cuckolding ploy?
No, probably not. Her kid's really sweet, and I have a feeling she has, like, a really wonderful relationship with her husband. But it is kind of, like, nice to show off, like, oh, look, I'm, like, a bookstore guy, and I can speak Spanish to your kid.
You can have a wonderful relationship with your husband and a wonderful relationship with someone else.
It's true, an extramarital relationship?
Yeah, you shouldn't judge.
That's true. Maybe she's non-monogamous. I don't know.
Can I quickly ask this? If we're talking about, like, sort of sexy historical figures. Ooh. In film, it's like Anna Karenina. She's yes. A big one, at least for me. What about in history? Who is, like, the more sexy historical figures?
We love, like, exciting people, you know? We love people who get out into the world and really leave a mark, whether it's good or bad. Let's go with China, right? We have the legendary, well, pseudo-legendary, definitely real, but, like, Wu Zeshan, that's her name?
Walter's just crying and scribbling around, trying to, like, yeah, I know about history, too, from China, my homeland.
No, she was this only female empress of China. She, like, effectively played her way to the top of the ladder. You gotta love her for it, because she literally, like, put up with tremendous amounts of shit just to sit on the throne, you know? It's, like, what every hustler wishes they could be.
In China, we like to use the number four a lot in yes. our history. So she's the four most beautiful woman. And obviously, she's not beautiful because you can't see the picture, but it's like beautiful, and like their beauty sort of makes an impression on Chinese history. The funny thing though is when I was learning about her as like a adolescent eighth grader, her picture was not beautiful. In fact, it was kind of fat, and we would always laugh and be like, oh, this beautiful Chinese girl.
You guys have been influenced by the West too much. We made you all think that fat wasn't beautiful.
Exactly. Because you needed fat in the past. Otherwise, you'd be like a poverty-starving farmer, and that was not an attractive thing back in those days.
When it was like that back in Europe, too, right? Like, back in the olden days?
Yeah, definitely way back when. Just to come back to it real quick before we get from it too far, I do know who the four beauties are. She was not one of them.
Oh, fuck, I made a mistake!
You dumbass!
It was Xixi, Wang Zhaojun, Dao Chan, and Yang Guifei. I think.
You have to tell me what they did. I know one of them is the Three Kingdoms girl who destroyed Liu Han, right? I don't remember the other three.
It sounds like you motherfuckers are talking about Lord of the Rings, honestly.
Dude, the romance of the Three Kingdoms is the Lord of the Rings in, like, kinda real life, kinda.
Yeah, no, I don't know much about the romance of the Three Kingdoms. Isn't that what the Dynasty Warrior games are kind of, like, loosely based yes. on? Like, there's, like, Liu Bu and stuff like that?
Oh, I meant Liu Bu, not Liu Han. Okay, maybe this is something that's, like, not true, but I kind of feel the Sengoku period in Japan has been marketed to the West way better than the mm-hmm. Romance of the Three Kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And do you think it's just because anime, baby! Because I think The Romance of Three Kingdoms is written in a more larger way. That's the word I want to use. I think Sengoku is amazing, but it's just not as large.
I'll tell you what I really think it is. I think it honestly comes back to the fact that, like, historically, we've been closer with Japan. Like, at least in more recent memory, like the advent of modern anime and whatever. And this is all conjecture. I'm basing this on literally nothing but what comes out of my ass. I think with China, we were on okay terms with China, at least at the beginning of the 20th century. Things changed, you know. We all know what happened, but at the end of the day, I really think it comes down to the fact that we've just been closer with one than the other, and it sucks because, like, China really does have a lot of beautiful art, culture, and literature to share with us, and that we could share with them, but there's a lot of us against them mentality right now.
Well, and if you, I think it's also worth pointing out that, like, if you look at, like, big points of damage on infrastructure and, like, loss of economic power, China's whole brush with Mao happened earlier, happened more recently, right? Japan has had longer to recover from Hiroshima, sort of create a global media sense, you know, and China had to deal with the fact that, like, a bunch of academics and intelligentsia, you know, were, like, just lost and destroyed, you know, during Mao's reign, and so there's a new group of people having to make art.
The secret is America and China love each other deeply. We just love each other in the worst way.
It's like every relationship that we know of. I will say, just so for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what happened in the past 100 years, basically we were talking about the four romance girls, the four most beautiful girls. The West threatened to add a fifth one, and that was a big no-no.
Yeah. It was Susan B. Anthony, actually. Susan B. Anthony was, every president had been sending letters to the various emperors of China throughout all of American history saying, Susan B. Anthony is going to be the fifth beauty treasure of China. You must understand. And then Mao finally was like, no way.
We tried to put forward Helen Keller, but for some reason she wouldn't speak her mind.
No. Jesus. She can't hear or see. Come on.
Yeah, she's dead. What's she going to do? Wave her fingers at me angrily.
That's true. I would also say Cleopatra was pretty hot history lady. Joan of Arc
was not fat because she was a peasant, but was Cleopatra kind of fat?
We have no idea. Like, with Cleopatra, it's definitely more of, you know, everyone kind of was, like, lusting after her because, you know, she's this, like, Greek Egyptian woman, you know, she's got all the power in her hands. She's there to be, in the eyes of the people from Rome, to be manipulated, which she was.
Dude, Joan of Arc, though, like, whenever Joan of Arc is in anime, holy fuck.
Well, because she's, like, blonde, German, and, you know, like, wait, actually, let me rephrase that, because Joan of Arc was French, not German, right?
Yeah, she was French.
Okay, let me go that again. Joan of Arc, you know, wait, fucking what did I say? Whatever, fuck it.
I don't know. There's the Madame X from... Madame X from...
X-Men?
No.
You talk about Magneto?
No. John Singer Sargent drew that one portrait of that lady. I think her name was, like, Amélie Gertrude, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she was...
And then she sunk the Titanic, right?
No, she was this... Dude, you should know her. She's Creole expat. She's from Louisiana swampland.
Dude, the swamp people don't understand, like, an actual history down there. They're just, like, they, like, count tree rings and, like, oh, yeah, my shelly. Oh, yeah. Except they don't even sound like that because they got terrible accents. Hey, boy, you churros, hey, come here. You're 15, come drink a beer. Fucking, that's not true. I love my relatives, sort of. No, if we're talking about beautiful people from Louisiana, gotta talk about, I don't know her real name, but Abby Shudo from NCIS, the black-haired girl, Louisiana native, New Orleans native. Oh my God, so beautiful.
The goth girl, yeah.
Yeah, she's so cute. NCIS, what a good show.
I remember being younger, not knowing that I was attracted to, like, the goth girl aesthetic, and then seeing her on the show, I was like, oh.
All right. I understand.
This is actually, I like that we brought it to, like, current people, because I was kind of curious if this is something history people like doing. Do they like predicting who's going to be a sexy figure in the future?
I mean, I...
What? No, this is just like you know, because, like, normal people would be, like, talking about, like, important historical things, like, you know, like, who are they going to talk about in 200 years? Not like, who's the sexiest woman to be in the history book?
whether historians weigh in on it or not, to answer the question seriously, we kind of do that now with all those, like, celebrity rag magazines that are 50 hottest celebrities alive today. We kind of do it already. I mean, especially with the advent of film, we have a dearth of beautiful people that, like, I think, honestly, at this point, we're looking for the uggos. We want some real nasty motherfuckers in history. We want some real hideous people to start peppering our history books.
So, like, Trump
I would not say Trump just because he's a bad man and was a bad president. He also, like, definitely has, like, a pretty repulsive energy. And it's, I think it's the way his lips work. So, for instance, Bush had nice human lips. Like, when he talked, he, like, seemed like a cute little joy boy. You know, like, someone who would, like, play pool with you and, like, take you back in his Camaro and maybe, like, give you, like, a little squeeze on the side, but not anything else unless you were into it. Like, he's, like, maybe a little pushy, but not too pushy, which isn't great, but, like, you're in high school and you kind of like it.
He also asks, do you want to watch me draw?
You want to watch me draw? Hey,
yeah, you want to come back to my daddy's house? I'm painting a portrait for you.
But Trump's mouth really does look like an asshole. It's very weird. It's very disconcerting. And it's part of the way he speaks. It's like a pursing of the lips.
You got to pucker and, like, lower your lips so it's down here.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Like, you're trying to do the posh.
While you're doing voices, can you also do Joe Swanson from Family Guy?
Hey, Peter. Hey, Peter. Come on, give me a hand out of this wheelchair, Peter. Peter.
Can you do Peter next?
Holy crap, Lois. Freaking sweet.
It's so good. We were playing D&D and you made a gnome sound exactly like Ron Swanson's voice actor, or Joe Swanson's voice actor. And I don't think anyone noticed but me, and I was secretly the most excited I'd been. I forget the gnome's name, but...
No, it was something stupid. It was like Willy
Your
Bar.
Nipples hard.
Yeah.
I brought with me today a episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation.
God, I want to kiss you.
No, me too. I also so. Arguably the first, like, really good episode of The Next Generation, season 2, episode 9, The Measure of a Man.
Star Trek's Generation is, Next Generation is weird because it is really good if you can get past the first season.
Yes, that's like a hard sticking point for a lot of people in terms of, like, entry into the series. Season 1 is, it's not, well, okay, I'm not gonna say that, because some of the episodes are bad, and same with the second season, but... There is a genuine super rise in quality about midway through season 2. You get a couple dips here and there, but once you hit season 3 on, it's banger after banger. It's good TV all the way up until, like, season 6.
And even then, there's good stuff.
I feel like Buffy
six.
Has that same narrative. First season, pretty not great, and then slightly rises in quality, inconsistent until someone leaves. Angel. Because Angel sucks!
I have to admit, I hate most of Joss Whedon's stuff. And so I've never actually watched Buffy.
Yeah, there was this time once Walter was visiting me in Roanoke, and Walter got completely trashed on, I can't remember what kind of whiskey we were drinking, but just rot gut whiskey. And Walter's just, like, sitting on my floor, like, with my mom and dad and little brother sitting around, just, like, hugging a pillow, rocking back and forth, like, nearly crying. Just being like, I just love Buffy so much. I just love Buffy. Man. I'm just like, yeah, well, come on. No, you know what it was? It was Maker's Mark. It was Maker's Mark, and at the end of the night, you went and puked off of my front porch.
Dude, I think I puked because I was so distressed how lonely I was that Buffy, not Sarah Michelle Gellar, but how Buffy did not exist and would not date me.
For what it's worth, knowing nothing about the show, I think Buffy would be friends with you, and maybe she'd see where it goes from there.
Oh, thank you. That's good. I can't tell if that will statement makes me feel better or makes me feel more lonely.
You know, I think it should make you feel better, because if someone's willing to expend the time and energy to be your friend, anything more than that, you know, that's a plus, right?
I know, but she doesn't exist.
Yeah, she's not real, Walt. You're gonna be alone forever. Get wrecked. Get fucked. Fucked!
Walter, you will find happiness one day. I believe this.
But not with Buffy.
No, not with Buffy, but you may be able to find someone who is Buffy adjacent. Hang out near fucking graveyards, I guess.
Or a Hot Topic.
What's the difference?
Yeah, so The Measure of a Man, back to that, it is like arguably the first really good episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation, I should say. It is based around the premise of a question to do with, like, artificial intelligence regarding, like, Data, who is an android. For those of you who don't know, he is not a human being. Well, that's the question of the episode, whether or not he is sentient. To give you an idea, and for those of you who do not know, Star Trek was made by Gene Roddenberry, kind of like a pioneer of like the sci-fi genre for creating Star Trek. It's in this weird place, Star Trek, because it came out at the time when a lot of pulp fiction sci-fi stuff was coming out, when America was like really big up on that stuff. Gene Roddenberry entered in with this idea of a human pseudo-utopian society where we met some of our space neighbors. From that, they helped us better ourselves and to find the human beings we kind of were meant to be. Like, it's a very romanticized idea of human beings and our ideals and how we should move forward. Outside of that, it's also a lot of very hacky, very fun sci-fi shit. If you like dumb two-page ideas of, like, what if, like, this little fuzzy fucker got onto the ship and, like, a bunch of them just kept fucking, filled the ship up dangerously to the point where we're gonna blow up if we don't get rid of these things. The Next Generation was a sequel, well, a continuation chronologically in the world of Star Trek after a very long break.
Yeah, it's what, 200 years, right? Give or take? 200-300 years?
I want to say it's like closer to 100, maybe.
Okay.
Just because some of the characters from the original show are still alive.
Yeah, because Kirk is not alive, but Spock is. Kirk is the captain from the original series, but Spock was his second in command.
Yes.
And Spock is an alien, so he lives for a super long time.
Yes, he is a Vulcan.
A Vulcan, exactly.
Throughout the 70s and 80s, the original series actually got like a bunch of movies that really revitalized and made a lot of the public fall in love with Star Trek. So by the time 1989 came around, people were like, yo, there's a new series of Star Trek coming on and it's going to be syndicated.
People were hype as shit.
Yes. Now we have a whole new cast of characters headed up one Patrick Stewart.
Who, he's just like so fucking good in that show. I mean, he is immaculate.
He is using the show as a fleshlight for his Shakespearean cock to jerk himself off with.
We're talking about like classically trained, like old school actor dude pretending to be like a space boy. And it works.
It really does. And it helps that a lot of the supporting cast are decent to really good.
One of the greats, LeVar Burton, master of reading Rainbow, also from Roots, played Geordi, the blind engineer. He has, like, robot eyes?
Yes, he was the chief engineer on the Enterprise.
Wait, why is he blind if he can see with his robot eyes? That means he's not blind.
It's this thing of, like, he can see, but he can't see the way humans see, right? He perceives the world differently from everyone else, and that's often, like, a touch point for him. Like, he is sometimes a little bitter about it. You know, it's about him coming to accept that and being like, you know what? I see the world in a different way that no one else does.
And yeah, and that's a fair point, because we do have words like blind as a dog, even though dogs are not blind. That's kind of fucked up now I think about it.
Do you mean blind as a bat?
Blind as a bat.
Bats are actually blind, though, right?
No.
Yeah, that's why people say blind as a bat. I mean, they're not completely blind, but they can't see well. That's why it's blind as a bat. No one says blind as a dog. What are you talking about, blind as a dog?
I hate dogs. I don't know what the fuck. No wonder I got this mixed up. Fuck dogs. Dogs suck.
Walt doesn't hate dogs. He loved his childhood dog so much, and it died, and he couldn't handle it, so now he pretends to hate all dogs, so he doesn't have to get close again.
I'm sorry, Walt.
Wow, I have been romanticized as a hero now.
Okay, but so we talked about Geordi. I think really what we need to talk about is Data, right? Because he's the crux of the episode.
Yes. So there are three people from the primary cast we have to focus on. There is Patrick Stewart, who plays Jean-Luc Picard. There is Jonathan Frakes, who plays Lieutenant Commander William T. Riker. And then there is Brent Spiner, who plays Data. Brent Spiner had the hardest shit in the world cut out for him.
Yeah.
Because not only did he have to consistently play like an android, literally not like a human the whole time, he had to nail down mannerisms. Like, he always does, like, this little head tilt to the side when people mm-hmm. say things that he doesn't understand. He doesn't use conjunctions. He doesn't say can't or shouldn't. He says cannot or should not. It's so many things like that set him aside and put him above, like, a lot of the other performances on the show because of how much work he has to put into it.
But he also doesn't sound like a robot. So he can't emote. He doesn't really have emotions. He's not just like speaking like a robot. He's still acting. It's really good.
Yeah, he manages to deliver it in like a level way that is not monotone, but it is interesting to listen to because he has this very even cadence and flow the way he speaks. And it sounds robotic, but it does not read as robotic.
It's almost like when you're talking to like a kid and the kid is calm and you're like, well, you know, because the fish, they can't come out of the water because they breathe water. And then the kid's like, how do they breathe water? Only it instead of being like, how do they breathe water? It's like, you need to put the positron expanditron into reverse or whatever.
Were you the kid in this story or the fish in this story?
You are both. I wish you were both right now. I wish you were a dead fish child in the ocean.
But Data, a lot of episodes that are focused on Data, Data wants to become more human. That is his, like, driving force. That is what makes him Data. And so...
So is this really rare for androids, though, to want to become human in Star Trek?
That's a fascinating thing. To Data's knowledge, at least at the beginning, he is the only android in the universe. The only functioning one that is, like, totally 100% independent. Come to find out later, there's, like, a quote-unquote brother android named Lore. He makes a daughter in a beautiful episode that, like, makes me cry when I watch it.
When Lore is played, is also played by the same guy who plays Data.
Exactly.
And so he gets to do his crazy emotions and stuff.
Yes, if you have ever seen that film called Master of Disguise.
Oh, I love that movie!
He is the antagonist in that film, and oh boy, I love him. I'd rather wished he had never done that, but... At the beginning of the episode, Data is, like, playing poker with everyone for the first time. He knows how to play it because he's got, like, a positronic brain. He, like, literally has the entirety of human knowledge, or Federation knowledge, really, in his head. He, like, literally can access, like, everything. They're all going around the table, putting in bets, and Data realizes that he has the best hand that he could basically have. As it comes back around and round and round, it comes back to just being him and Riker. And Riker does what you're supposed to do in poker. He bluffs. He lies. And Data does not understand this. So in Data's mind, he's like, oh, that must mean he literally has a better hand than I do. I should fold. And when they reveal their cards, Data's like, wait a minute, your hand was worse than mine. And he's like, yeah, I was lying. And it's this nice little touchstone to, like, kind of explain how Data is still learning. He knows everything, but he is learning in, like, the way that a kid learns. Skip forward a little bit. Some people come visit the ship, and then there is a man who follows on board with an admiral who's visiting to look at the Enterprise, whatever. Okay, I want to make a note of this dude. Commander Bruce Maddox, he's played by a guy named Brian Brophy. I don't know if that dude's been in anything else, but he does such a good job at playing this, like, tremendous dickhole. They do a great job at casting their minor bit characters for episodes. They often have to, because they're the focus outside of one of the central pieces of the cast. He is a cyberneticist. He's interested in Data. He comes on board and he's like, Data, I want to poke around in your head because I want to figure out how to make more of you. And Data's like, well, I know your records. He's like, listen, bitch, I've seen your report card. You can't touch me because you're going to fuck me up if I let you poke around in my brain.
He's just not a very good scientist.
Not a good enough one. That would be a fairer statement.
This is like basically if we approach Bruce Willis to be a host and he told us that Suede isn't handsome enough for him to be a host on this podcast.
Right, you gotta do that. You gotta do me like that, Walt.
You gotta be more handsome, man. You gotta get more handsome.
I am so goddamn handsome.
Listen, Everyone on this show right now is more handsome than him, okay? I'm just going to throw that out there.
I mean, that's just absolutely patently false. Bruce Willis is a hottie.
Nah, Bruce Willis is bald, and that means he's going to hell.
That's true, but I'd go to hell with him. I'd give him a smooch.
So, Picard is talking to Data later, and Data's like, yeah, I know this dickhole. He was basically the only dude on the Council of People who decided whether or not I got into Starfleet. He was the only person who said, no, I shouldn't be in Starfleet. So there's a little bit of, like, prior history between them. Episode goes on, there's a really awesome, just, like, court scene back and forth talking about the validity of Data's existence, whether or not he is property as a thing, or whether or not he has proven that he is a sentient being. It is just this wonderful back and forth between Picard, another, like, captain, who's kind of like the judge, and then because they don't have enough staff at the place that they're parked at in space right now, Riker has to be the offense for the cyberneticist dude. He has to make the case against him.
And that's hard, because Data and Riker get along.
Yes, Data is, like, friends with everyone in the, like, immediate staff. They all love him and value him, not only for his abilities, but also for the fact that he is this own unique entity that kind of exists in defiance of the idea of what humans think life should be or how it should come to be. So it goes back and forth. It seems like Riker's got a really good case. And then Picard comes back, and he goes and he talks to Guinan, who was played by Whoopi Goldberg. They basically have a conversation where Whoopi Goldberg, as kind of like the spiritual advisor for the ship, he goes and he talks to Guinan, and Guinan basically pulls up the example of slavery on Earth as an allegory for what they're doing to Data, or what they're proposing they do to Data. And Picard gets, you see it on his face in that moment, his justice boner rising. You see this righteous fury take over him, like, deeper inside, and he's like, okay, I'm going back to that courtroom, and I'm gonna make this fucking Hail Mary of a pass, right? So he goes back in, talks to them, and they ultimately rule in the favor of Data. I actually pulled the decision that Captain Louvois, the judge, makes. It sits there looking at me, and I don't know what it is. This case has dealt with metaphysics, with questions best left to saints and philosophers. I am neither competent nor qualified to answer those. I've got to make a ruling to try and speak to the future. Is Data a machine? Yes. Is he the property of Starfleet? No. We've all been dancing around the basic issue. Does Data have a soul? I don't know that he has. I don't know that I have. But I have got to give him the freedom to explore that question himself. It is the ruling of this court that Lieutenant Commander Data has the freedom to choose. And it really comes back to, like, the reason that I wanted to bring this to the podcast, and the reason I really wanted to talk about this, because it has less to do with the allegory of whether or not Data was property, and it has more to do with the question of, does Data have a soul? Can Data be human? While aspiring to be human, can he be human? As someone who has struggled with schizophrenia for a very long time, it's very hard for me to connect with people or to express myself in a way that others can kind of see as, like, not robotic, to kind of use that parlance. I come across at times as, like, you know, an emotionless android, you know. I know what it seems like, and, you know, I've struggled with that for a long time. When I was younger, watching Star Trek and seeing Data, it really connected with me on a deeper level to see this character who struggles so much with wanting to be human. It was very relatable for me, because oftentimes, especially if I'm off my meds, or if for one reason or another, like, I feel like it's not working, or if I'm just really having a bad day, it feels hard to connect to other people and to feel like what I have with anyone else is pertinent or important. If I am myself human, because I don't feel or perceive the world the way others can or do. It really means a lot that a character like Data exists, that I can look to Data and see him and be like, you know what? He is clearly not human by our own standards, but he is the most human of all of us because of his deeper understanding of how he has to learn to be human. It's a beautiful lesson you can take away from basically any episode that focuses exclusively on him. It's what made me fall in love with the series. It's what made me fall in love with the character of Data. It's what really centered me in a lot of very dark times.
Yeah, I think perspective is so difficult for some people. You know, this like devout belief that reality is objective and it is exactly what we see. And I think it actually causes a lot of issues, especially for people who don't sort of fall on the neurotypical scale, whatever parlance you want to use to describe it. I think a lot of people end up in really unpleasant situations because of it. I've seen my own family sort of like take umbrage with the way other people are perceiving reality. And instead of like taking a step back to try and understand where they're coming from, just like instant frustration. I think you're right. I think Data is very good at being sort of this like window into someone who is in a safe enough space to exist in another reality, right? Like say like whose perception is so different from our own, but has a community that like holds him and like keeps him from falling into the cracks. Which doesn't happen in reality here on Earth. I mean, like, there's so many people who are on the street because their perception of reality is different, whether it's mental illness or addiction or, you know, whatever. Like, people perceive different reality.
And he's a good focal point to bounce questions off of. Questions that we ought to ask ourselves. Why do I fold my laundry the way that I do? It means nothing. Ultimately, if it fits in the drawer and it works, like, why do I do it that way? Well, it's because it's the way I do it. He answers a lot of questions that I think we ourselves are often very uncomfortable with asking. Data is something that I feel a lot of people should be... He is the character that people should aspire to be more like, because he takes the time to listen to others, to formulate his experiences and his view of the world based on the input that he receives as, you know, effectively a machine, but a machine that can think, and later on, a machine that can feel.
This is going to sound really rough, but I just wanted to bring up, there's a idea that I personally really like called object-oriented ontology.
Bro,
which is basically...
It's oriented.
What am I saying?
Orientated. It's oriented.
Is it really that different? Okay, well...
What is object-oriented ontology?
That's a good question. Honestly, you know what? If you're going to put me on the spot, I'm going to have to say I don't really know. But my best way to explain it, it's a understanding in philosophy where because we're trying to destroy a understanding of a normative human, and that goes into identity politics. A lot of identity politics are like, God damn it, world, we have this perfect human that you think everyone wants to be, but I am my own identity and I'm different from it. So the more and more people had conversations like this, naturally people started wondering, okay, if there are no normative humans, can we look at things that are not even human and wonder if they have potentiality to be human? I don't love where that part is, but I like the idea that objects are one of the biggest representations of destroying a normative human. For me, I've always just found object-oriented ontology the easy answer to our frustration with the normative human. So if all objects had an opportunity to become human, then you would break open that entire understanding of what a human is, and it would just fix these questions really easily. Unfortunately, the world is not so easy, and you're never going to find an easy answer for it.
Well, I was going to say to that point, Walter, humans have this tendency. We become familiarized and I would say even like a little attached to objects, you know. We give them personality when, you know, it could be argued that they have none. I have a favorite bowl that I eat out of. Why is it my favorite bowl? I have six others in my cabinet, but it's the bowl I always pick first for whenever I'm making curry, because I'm like, it tastes better when it's coming out of this bowl.
Yeah. The reason why that bowl is your favorite is not just because you have given the bowl personality. I truly believe that bowl itself has a type of personality that was given to you too. People just don't recognize it when they talk about it in a normal life, right? They always think, I'm giving an object personality. I'm giving an object personality. But I think if you make the connection or have an object that has personality, I really think there's a relationship. I don't think it's a solo one-way projection. Whether or not that's existence, being, or whatever you want to call it, There's something there.
Talking a little bit about object-oriented ontology, I think there's, and also data, Deleuze and Guattari have two philosophers from the 70s, and they have a text called Anti-Oedipus, and a lot of it I don't quite understand. But the one thing that I really liked is it reduces everything, instead of having singular identities, everything's about connections. So it talks about the connections between your finger bones and also the connections between your cells and your human body, and then also your connections between you as a sovereign person of a nation, and says that instead of all of these relationships being within the context of your point of view, each one of these intersecting vertices is like almost its own kind of identity, right? So that instead of human beings being the central, each point of connection and each act of connection is its own like manifestation of an identity. I think data really brings that to a total head, right? Because you have someone who is both an object and someone who is capable of making connections, right? There's no way you can look at data who is technically not flesh and blood and then say, no, he's not making these connections. And data is also a member of Starfleet, right? He is an individual within the context of Starfleet. He's an individual within context of his community, right? It illustrates this sort of like need for connection. I think the only problem with that in the framework of Star Trek as a piece of media is that there's no way to like make any piece of media that's narrative that's also like, look at the way the gears are meshing, only it's not just gears, it's also our bones and our connections to other people, right?
Well, I don't mind Deleuzing data, because if you think about it like this, if data woke up in a junkyard and there was no humans around, he probably look a little less human than what he does on the Starfleet.
That's very true.
But you can also apply that to Captain Kirk. If Captain Kirk, flesh and bones, woke up in a junkyard with no humans around, he would probably look a little less human.
Oh no, that's what happens with these like fuckers who live out in Slough is from my area for a little bit, but before that he's from Buffalo. But I know he knows this. These motherfuckers who come down like from out of the woods, who are just like so isolated.
Yep, the mountain people.
Yeah, they're not bad people necessarily, but some of them are so out of shape when it comes to human interaction.
Yeah.
And I'm with them. Like, fucking, after we all, like, shut down for COVID, my, like, first few times leaving the house, I was like, ah! Like, I was, like, slobbering on myself and, like, biting people's legs and stuff. So I get it. I think that's actually how a lot of bad people end up being bad, is there's nothing, like, ontological about the way that they're bad. It's the context that they're raised in.
I think everyone is a reflection of what they grew up around. Not just people, but the environment, the things they interacted with. We are the sum of our parts, whatever those parts may be.
That's why people back in olden times were dumb, because they didn't, like, know shit or whatever. They're just like, hey, I have a stick and I'm gonna make a fire. And then Descartes was like, a dog's probably a robot, and spend, you know, everyone's just, people from the past are so dumb.
Yeah, now we jerk off to fake women on the screen.
That's true.
Like, dude, that's so much more real. I will say though, like, I know like object oriented ontology is like a fucking dead thought, but that's why I wish there was like some power in it, because I hated the language I used just now when I talked about data waking up in a junkyard, that he would look less human. Less human is such a shit word, you know? If objects were just human, I would not need to say data was less human in a junkyard. He would just be a different type of human.
It's attributing like a binary to something that doesn't have a binary. Yeah. You know, it's not measured on that scale. We call something more or less human based on what? Based on like, who is the most human? It doesn't make sense in terms of measurement.
Yeah. And you literally reminded me and made me instantly regret my language choice when you brought up actual humans who are isolated and have different relationships. I never want to call them less human. That's like a shit thing to say, but our language is so crap that.
Yeah, no, and if it means anything, as someone who knows like next to nothing about what you were talking about when you first brought it up, it makes sense to me what you are saying, and I kind of agree with it, at least the way you've put it. So.
Yeah, scores! Go!
It makes sense to me because, like, objects are and will always be a part of our reality, and how we interact with them will forever be important.
I have so many objects that I think are more human than most humans. I swear to God, dude.
I mean, I have a habit of naming both my car and my cell phone pretty regularly. I say, where is she? Where's my cell phone, Chan?
Dude, I thank fucking God the 2D lords gave us 2D, man.
Yeah.
Thank fucking God.
I'm ready for it. I'm ready to transcend. I'm done with this. I just want to go hang out with freaking...
Dude, I can't wait. I can actually hang out with Buffy one day.
I could hang out with Harley Quinn, the TV cartoon version, not any other version.
It's honestly so mind-blowing to me that people shit on 2D and, like, freak out when they think of, like, reality like that. Because it's just like, what are you doing? The world is so boring. You can hang out with a cute moe anime girl, and that's not attractive? I just don't fucking get it,
man. I think it depends on what you get out of a relationship. Coming back to object-oriented ontology, right? You clearly extract more from that than you do, at least with people at this point in time. I think one day people will be married to fully real, working, like, hard light holograms that are effectively human, for whatever that means again, you know.
Right.
At least in the meantime, it makes me sad when people marry Hatsune Miku, because Hatsune Miku is not... She's not quantifiable on the scale of being able to reciprocate the things that we need on an emotional level. She can be a binary that reflects it back. It's like, is the horny switch on or off?
Right.
She can sing you some songs.
I mean, I think you could say the same thing about animals, right? Like, this is kind of pushing things a little bit.
No, it isn't. I would say that animal conversation happened before the object-oriented ontology.
That was one of Descartes' big things, right? Was that, like, animals didn't have souls, animals weren't alive, kind of in the same way humans were. And I love my cat very much, and I think... that she is, like, a real being that has, like, emotions and thoughts and feelings, and I have interacted with her in that context. But sometimes when you interact with an animal, especially one that's, like, very foreign to you, when you put emotions on that animal, it's kind of a guessing game. And I don't think it's that far of a leap to say you could get the same thing from a PNG of Hatsune Miku that you jerk off to. Personally, I think Hatsune Miku is not that great of a waifu. I think there are better ones out there. But I'm just saying, like, I think I can get there a little bit.
I'm sorry, I'm not up to date on my lore on all the Hololive people.
Dude, Hololive VTubers represent, yes!
Go, Chad! Let's go!
I know Iron Mouse, I know Gwargura, right? That's
dude,
one.
Dude, Iron like... Mouse. Fucking Subathon Iron Mouse right now. Go support Iron Mouse's Subathon.
No, don't support...
support this podcast.
Support this podcast, then...
No. Give Iron Mouse a subscribe and make sure you write from fake film fans.
I don't like Iron Mouse. I like Gargura. I like Gura.
Dude, you can't fucking say that, man. You can't say you don't like Iron Mouse.
I don't. I like Gura better. She's adorable. Gura, if you're listening to this, please just be on the podcast. You'd make me so happy.
The thing about the animal conversation, too, is that a lot of people like to think of it and like, okay, I can see we have this type of relationship with animals. Maybe it can go to objects. But it's the reverse, too. People think they don't need to guess when they talk to humans. You're always guessing.
Yeah.
People forget that.
I'm really guilty of that personally. Like, and I put it up more to my schizophrenia than anything. I see people as different parts, right? To me, this is how I interpret people.
Mm-hmm.
I'll use you as an example, Suede.
Yeah.
I am pretty familiar with you. And at any given time, I may not know what's going to come out of your mouth, but I do know about the 20 things that are in your wheelhouse that you are likely to talk about.
Yes, exactly. You've probably picked up on some of my mannerisms, right? Like when I like, it's very clear that I need a cigarette.
Yes.
Like when I'm like super distracted about something and you're pretty good at like trying to focus me. And I think a lot of people do that. I think it's necessary. I it's not always super fun. Sometimes it would be chill to just like let people do, like just let people be and not have to like try and figure out what's coming out of their mouth next. Yeah, dude, I don't know. Human interaction's complicated. It doesn't ever get easier.
It never will.
And that's good.
No, it is good that it's weird and challenging because it makes us grow. That's all you can really take away from
it. Yeah, pretty much.
I thought this podcast was going to be a history podcast. Therefore, I will continue that trend. I brought a history film. I wanted to abuse Slough's history prowess, and I brought Death of Yazdegerd, whatever the fuck the king is called.
Yazdegerd. Yeah.
And it's about time I brought an Iranian film for that last conversation we had when I talked about Iran and Brazil being super underrated countries. I'm just gonna fucking give up right away. I don't know this context history at all, and I don't think even if I did the research, I would do it justice. So, Slough, do you want to go ahead and give it a try?
Yeah, sure. This is the period of history from the fall of Rome to the year 1500. That is like my bread and butter. I love the medieval era. And when you brought this to me and you were like, yeah, this is what I'm watching, I was like, oh my god, I'm so excited. Because Yazdegerd has a really fun story. He was the king of kings of Persia, effectively. He was the last of Sassanian kings, a dynasty who ruled over Iran, or what is modern day Iran, I should
Wait,
say.
Wait, Zoroastria different from Sassanian?
Zoroastrianism?
Yeah.
Sassanian is the name of the dynasty, and Zoroastrianism is the religion that they practiced. So at this time, there were a series of conflicts in the Middle East. This is during a period called the Muslim conquest of Persia, or the Arabic conquest of Iran. Effectively, what happened was it was not even 100 years after the Prophet Muhammad gave his declarations and Islam, as we know it, was founded. And Persia has been on a backslide for a long time. They were originally founded after Alexander the Great came through, put a dude on the throne there, and then ipso facto, people come in, cultures mix. Now it's Persia. Persia is on a massive decline. I mean, we're talking about, like, it's falling apart. If you're not within the direct area of control for the kingdom, you're basically an independent country. Yazdegerd was the third of his name. He was put on the throne at, like, 6. So, you know, he was a figurehead at first. And that meant that all of the people that were close to him were fighting for political power. That led to a lot of infighting, a lot of rebellions, and a lot more crumbling. And so where, at least the story of the film picks up, Yazdegerd is rallying support as the Muslims push in to Iran.
I get the story is fascinating and a really fun story to tell, but what's the power of this specific story? Like, the mythness of it and the legacy of it? Obviously, for a lot of people outside of this area, it's like zero, right?
Yeah, I've never heard of this dude.
So I'm more asking, like, for the ignorant, how much power actually does this story have? Besides just the fact that it was a young king
so
who was killed in a really random place.
Historically speaking, to understand where societies come from, what they do, and then where they go, or what they become. As was the Persian Empire, you know, the Persian Empire would never truly exist again. There would be successors who would call themselves that, but ultimately, the Persian Empire, as we historically know it, ended officially with Yazdegerd. And it is this culmination of history, of culture, of time, at this one point where it could have gone, well, no, it couldn't have gone anyway. There was no way. There was no fucking way Yazdegerd was beating back the Muslim invaders. I'm sorry. Ultimately, it's the snapshot of history where we love tragedy. More than that, we love tragedy that is farcical and perhaps even a little bit hilarious in retrospect. Because it's like, there's no way this kingdom's coming back, not without a miracle. And this dude is like out trying to get 20 peasants with pitchforks to come fight with him. And there's no fucking way.
It helps that there's distance, right? Because like, you know, give 250 years, there's going to be stuff in American history that, like, mattered a shit ton to people that's going to be really funny. Assault on the Capitol, whatever you fucking want to call it. That took a few months, but it got funny. It's funny now, I would say, right? I mean, like, within the moment, it was a little
spooky.
Dude,
it's like when you were born. That was a historical moment that was incredibly funny. Now that time has passed.
Yeah, right?
I will say to that credit, at least, there's the 20-year rule. If 20 years have passed, it's probably okay to joke about it.
That's a good rule. You are 20.
That's true. That's true, and I am a joke.
Well, the reason why I asked that specific question about the myth and the legacy is because it sort of reminded me not just how biased education is, but how biased storytelling is. And I can't speak for everyone, but I think if you get into history at all as a kid, it comes through storytelling first, foremost, not from the history book of reading about the dates and the names and all that stuff. That's not what is attractive. It's like your dad sitting you in bed. And obviously, as someone who grew up in Hong Kong, a lot of the stories that were the most interesting to me were the China ones, because you didn't hear them in school as much. I'm just curious, like, how this story would be told if it was like a type of bedtime story.
And it gets to like a certain aspect of storytelling that comes back more how the East and West tell stories, right? In the West, if we were to tell this story, it would be about a prince who becomes a king, who is struggling against this great enemy. And classically, we would tell he overcomes the challenge. You know, that's a lot of Western storytelling. Whereas I feel like it would be at least a lot more common in the East for him to fall flat on his fucking face, like he does in reality. And for the lesson to be like, hey, he was wasting his time and energy doing this. The real lesson from this is to take, like, what he could have done or what he should have been doing.
Speaking of lessons, though, thinking about the different type of lessons that some of the stories I know, you know, the general who was basically sent to die, he knew he was going to die and he got his wife to just write a poem about like how he was so loyal to his country. And then obviously he went out and died. And in China, we talk about it like, yo, this is what really it's about, being loyal to your country. I feel like the Western is just like, how is this guy so fucking stupid?
Nah, dude, there's the same story. It's similar. I can't remember his name, but during the Revolutionary War, and he was like, give me liberty or give me death, and they hang him or whatever.
Is that Abraham Lincoln?
Pretty sure it was Abraham Lincoln. No, there was some like dude, some like Revolutionary War guy. I don't know.
From Patrick Henry?
Yeah, sure.
Patrick Henry is the guy who said, give me liberty or give me death.
And then they hung him, and he didn't care because he was an American, and it was great.
The movie Independence Day, right? That's where
Independence Day, exactly. Yeah, the aliens? Will Smith, he said, give me liberty or give me death, and then he said, welcome to Earth, bitch, and punched the alien, and then they tried to kill him because of America, because of the Revolutionary War.
To both of your credits, let's take two steps back real quick. Patrick Henry was not executed for saying that. He said that at the Virginia convention. He was getting everyone to agree with him to start the Revolutionary War. The guy you were thinking about, Walt, I think is Yue Fei.
Shrugs.
There was this show called, oh my god, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like History Kids or something like that. And it was this cartoon show on PBS about the Revolutionary War, where it was just like kids in the Revolutionary War. And there's this one episode about this guy who's like captured by the British. They want him to like squeal on his homies, on the Revolutionary War guys. And he's like, no way. And then he has some like famous thing that he says, and then he just hangs.
Guy who was hanged.
I think his name was like Todd Renderson? Grundle Grambleson?
Tom Brady?
It's Tom Brady. Tom Brady, actually, they tried to hang Tom Brady for Deflategate, and he said, give me liberty or give me death.
And then he threw them away.
He threw them away with his football skills.
Yeah.
Football kills, football skills.
He wouldn't stop trying to kiss his son full on the lips, so they had to put him in the noose.
Dude, what a good football guy. What a champion, sun-kissing football man. I'm approving.
Is there a historical sports figure that's, like, really famous?
Yeah, fucking rest in peace, John Madden. Honestly, give us five stars John Madden.
I mean, like, older than that.
There's literally the dude Spartacus.
Oh. Yeah. You're right.
It's the same. Sports then were the same as they are now, where it's kind of fleeting, right? Where, like, you have a heyday where everyone knows your name. And then once you get a little too old, rickety, or back then, you know, you stepped on a pebble wrong and you caught, like, syphilis, you get forgotten about. And it's a consequence of history. It's a consequence of how humans are. Admittedly, we can only be bothered to care for so long as you can keep our attention.
And I will always have attention for John Madden. Rest in peace.
Dude, me and my brother were talking about this, but back in the days when war was on, people would get no contact injuries where they would tear their MCL or ACL, and in sports it's like such a huge deal. But in war, it would be like, holy fuck, witchcraft, he fucking fell and died. Fucking, like, you marching with a flag, people probably think, like, a witch got him or something.
I mean, that's what John Madden thought. John Madden was constantly searching for football witches. He was so mad all the time. And he would point to the cheerleaders and say, which one to use a football witch? And they would give him a juice box, a juice pouch.
He would bring out his magic stylus, a la, like, those people on the Disney Channel who are like, this is me and this is Disney Channel. And he would start drawing on the field. He would start drawing, like, stick men, like, looking for the truth.
John Madden actually stole Ariana Grande's magic Disney wand. That's why she became a pop star.
John Madden is Ariana Grande.
That's true. That's why we haven't heard any new Ariana Grande songs, is because she's John Madden and she died.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so this film is, as you said, The Death of Yazdegerd. First of all, this movie is based off a play, so there's a lot of talking. I mean, the story's not that important, right? The king gets killed in a miller's house, and there's a bunch of generals being like, how the fuck this happened? You guys are gonna die, to the miller and his family. A miller, his wife, and his daughter. The story is retold by the three characters who are accused of murder, trying to say that we did not kill this king, because if they did, it would be really, really bad, the punishment. And they tell this general the story by basically reacting the scenes of the king talking to them and ordering them and what happened. So there is a bit of, like, role reversal stuff there going on. Or one of my favorite role reversal scenes is when the daughter pretends to be the king and the king is basically trying to flirt with the mother. So the daughter ends up basically flirting with the mother. It's honestly kind of hot too. But yeah. Maybe role reversals are not that important, but for me as a horny boy.
This is like when SpongeBob, like, pushes Mr. Krabs up against the wall and it's like, yeah. I work for you, but tonight you work for me. And he, like, spanks Mr. Krabs' big red ass cheeks. Like, that is what we're talking about.
SpongeBob, me boy.
I think this film is a very interesting example of how films can be poetic, because a lot of times when people think of poetic movies, they think of, like, slow, long shots of meditative sort of poetry. But this film does not use that at all, but it's incredibly poetic because of how rhythmic it is. I think every medium can be rhythmic in a very unique way, but this film has a very unique way to make cinema itself.
Well,
rhythmic.
When you talk about rhythm, are you talking about the rhythm within the way the shots are presented, with the way the dialogue is presented, with the way the characters move on screen?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's everything. When we're talking about dialogue, every single line is delivered, and then the next line happens. No interruptions. There might be a big exclamation right after a line, but it's like, deliver line, boom! The next line happens. And the shots, cuts, also follow that a lot of the times. Someone will deliver a line, someone interrupts, and the shot immediately cuts at that interruption.
This film was based on a play, so obviously a lot of it's going to be very theatrical and very focused on, you know, the scenes as they might have been presented on a stage, right? And one of the famous examples, right? Clerks. It's a good movie, but it's also a lot of back and forth interactions between two people in a scene.
The whole dick sucking scene, the whole, like, how many dicks did you suck on the way out, right? Like, there's, like, rhythm, and that anytime Jay and Silent Bob talk to each other, I mean, mostly it's Jay doing the talking, it's, like, so hyper-rhythmic. Humor is based on rhythm in a lot of ways, so it doesn't feel poetic in the same way, but if you had them, like, talking about stuff that wasn't goofs and jokes, it would be almost exactly the same.
I feel like, too, what you're talking about is just, like, a well-paced film. Like, there's no fat on it. It's all contributing to the end goal of getting to the conclusion.
That's a fair point too. Yeah, it could just be good cuts and good movies have good rhythm, and that's, like, it. I think the reason why I feel this film has poetic nature to it is that the rhythm, while is rhythmic, as I said, it's also circular. Number one, this guy is a miller, so the thing he uses to mill wheat is a round stone circle. Also, the setting, they're basically inside a sort of dome-like room. And the outside, Arabs are coming. So the outside is very, very busy. But you almost never get to see it, except in, like, four scenes where the door opens. And you see outside where there's a bunch of armies and things going on. And then it closes. And they're kind of just shut in this, like, circle dome. You asked me about movement. A lot of times when a character is about to give his line to the other character, they're walking in circles around that character. One of my favorite shots, the Miller is like crying about how he didn't kill the king and he's on his knees and the camera's zooming in with a close up and his two girls are next to him and they're just swaying and like slowly moaning like, ugh. And because the camera's like closing in on him, it creates this sort of like weird moving flow of rhythm, I guess. That's all I can really describe it.
I think what you brought up about the cyclical nature of the storytelling in this movie, circles in and of themselves have meaning in storytelling. Like even the story of this king who is murdered in the back end of nowhere is cyclical and its power rises, it falls, and then it rises again in a different way. And ultimately, I think the point of it is it doesn't really matter who the actors are because it has happened and it will happen again. But what makes it interesting is the moment by moment in which it occurs, at least.
And how it's retold. Yes. It was just sickler in that way, too.
You mentioned they're in that domed room. Domes were popular because of the scarcity of wood, and that was something that came out of Mesopotamia.
Wait, explain that. How does that work?
So the idea was that you could build a simple structure, because obviously there's a lot of sand, and like harsh winds and things like that. And by building these domes, like, you don't want to build an angular roof like you might, like how, you know, a kid draws a house.
Because it's going to get toppled by the wind at that point.
It's that, but it's also the fact that when sand piles on, that's a lot of weight. And if it's not rounded, it won't accumulate, so it'll just trickle off. It's one of those brilliant innovations that we as humans figured out super early.
Why have we stopped building round houses?
I mean, it depends on where you live, I suppose. I mean, at least these days, with the advent of, like, steel and super powerful metals, the fuck is sand gonna do, you know? Like...
But there's still stuff still like that happens. I mean, if you go to Vermont, all the houses look totally different than the houses down here in Roanoke, and it's because they have to deal with snow.
Yes.
Because the snow will make your house fall down. Snow is big, snow heavy, snow make house fall
down. Up north, you want to have, like, an angled roof. You want a roof that's almost a pinpoint because you want the snow to gather and, like, slide off. You don't want a flat roof because then it'll pile on and then you've got a hole in your roof.
In Roanoke, you need a patio so you can drink beer and throw rocks at your dog when you're like drunk and angry. You can like look at your hot neighbor and just like covet her.
Yeah, there's no hot people in Vermont, so that's why you can't look at hot neighbors there.
No, there's no attractive people in Vermont. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, our Vermonters.
When there are other people, you're related to them, so you know.
Well, how come they don't build domes in Vermont then?
I think it really comes down to, like, style preferences in the West and how people built things. At least here in the U.S., domes are reserved for state buildings, libraries, or, like, an administrative office. Out here, we fell in love with, like, 1,000 different styles, and part of the American identity is building anything, and it's like, yeah, that probably belongs here, I guess.
Well, it's also probably easier to build a pyramid shape or a triangle shape than it is a dome, right? Like, I could take the, like, objects I have right now and build a triangle shape. I would be very hard-pressed to, like, take my PlayStation 4, like, disc holders and try and make a dome. But I guarantee I could make a triangle with not too much effort.
The idea of it is, like, a triangle might be simpler in, like, concept, but, like, with a dome, effectively, you just have to curve multiple pieces of wood in the same way until it makes the circle. At the end of the day, like, they did it because they didn't have a lot of wood in the Middle East, so...
They had to use sand. They had to make sand domes.
No, they didn't use sand, but...
where did they use rocks?
Snow?
Snow? Did they use snow?
It's called sandstone. It is not sand, but it is sandstone.
Yeah, I'm also kind of imagining an apartment complex that is shaped like a dome. I bet, like, the top floor would be, like, so triggered compared to, like, the bottom floor.
It would depend on how you laid it out, right? Because as the circle rounds off, right? Like, if you're building, like, up and down, you're gonna get less space as you go up, but more as you come down towards the center, and then less as you get to the bottom again.
Silos are round. Silos? Silos are round. Corn silos.
Oh, what? Oh, yeah.
That's round.
What if we lived in spheres? That would be cool. You'd be eating, and then your food would get onto your face, because it would roll.
What if the Earth was a sphere? Can you imagine if the Earth was round?
Thank you.
I watched a movie called Cemetery Man. I liked it, but I don't know if I want to really talk about it on the podcast. I'll just quickly say that there are a lot of zombie titties, and there is a hilarious part where a dude shoots a nurse in the face for telling him not to smoke cigarettes in the hospital. Knowing these two things, that there are zombie titties and a guy shoots a nurse, and the film's title is Cemetery Man, how would you make this movie? And this is a game that you can lose. I will be doing the judging.
I feel like it's about a cemetery ghoul who collects grave dust and, like, grave moss. He lays it out in the sun, so he has, like, a little crispy bacon treat in the morning. And so there's this nurse, her sugar daddy has died recently, and she's attending his funeral, so it looks like she's cut out, or, you know, she's gonna get in on the money. And she notices this little grave man, this little ghoul, this little cemetery man, creeping around eating his grave.
Walter, you've not said anything, so you are losing right now.
Okay, fine. I feel like because we were talking about object-oriented ontology, I think it's a shovel. A shovel wakes up and thinks to himself that he kind of wants to be more human. He wants to be more like a man. The shovel is, like, moving. He can't really dig without the man, so that creates many metaphysical questions. But he manages to get enough dirt to meet a corpse, and the corpse is a man. Is the corpse more man than the shovel is, or is the shovel more man than the corpse is?
Okay, well, you didn't include the nurse, so we're going to go with Slough's beginning. We've done the first act. The first act is Ghoulman, Saul Ghoulman, graveyard ghoul at large. He and this sugar baby style nurse have met at a funeral. Well, act two, you go first.
Okay,
then we'll
so the nurse is a sugar babe. She is chain smoking, but she also is made out of sugar. So her whole body is candy, and she just has two mouths, two lips that are human, and it's just moving. And this man is freaking out. He's like, what the fuck is this? All right, Slough, you can take over.
No. That's not the second act. Well, you're just automatically going to lose. Slough, what's the second act?
Okay, so he's been watching this woman, and he realizes what's going on. And so, you know, they begin to talk to one another. It comes out that she's actually after her sugar daddy's prized possession, the Necronomicon.
Jesus Christ!
Which would allow you to summon a Cthulhu-esque entity that would please all of your olfactory senses.
So you're talking about a Naharlath Hotep, or maybe like Azakoth.
Nothing's gonna beat Necronomicon.
Yeah, I'm not gonna beat Necronomicon. Come Thulu, but that's not great.
No.
HP Loveshaft.
That's the writer of the Necronomicon.
That's the writer of the Necronomicon, HP Loveshaft.
And he eventually follows her to the manor because he's like, this is too much power for one person to have. And I want to continue eating my graveyard bacon. So he like stalks her there.
Okay. So, Walt, you didn't have a plot, you didn't have a structure, you just talked about a woman who was made of candy but had lips that were human. I was into that, I would totally watch a separate film about that, but in a three-act structure, you need plot, so I'm gonna have to go with Slough.
In another world, we did a run-through of this where we made it Ghost.
Alright, we're gonna try this one more time, Walt. Take her home.
She's coming along with the goal, and they go to the house, and they eat breakfast, and there's an egg, and they eat it and finish it. Is that a three-part structure, you fucker?
No, that's not even a plot. That's just two people eating eggs, man. That's crazy. Walter, this is the story that you've set up, by the way. This is your story. There's a shovel that is a man, or wants to be a man, and he meets a woman who is made of candy.
No, he met a corpse. The shovel met a corpse.
That's true. He met a corpse. And then somehow there's a woman who's made of candy with human lips. What you've described is like when I drank too much NyQuil trying to make it through a shift at the theater and had to like lift boxes for our manager.
No. Walter has simply made an anthology, whereas I have made a continuous story.
That's true.
These are non sequiturs.
Yeah. These are intercut. The entire time that this is going on, the ghoul also eats hallucinogenic mushrooms. So he just has these like trips where he's like, oh fuck, now I'm a shovel. Okay, bring her home, Slough.
So there's dinner at the house on the hill, and he's there for the Necronomicon, and she's there for the Necronomicon. I'm going to keep saying Necronomicon because Suede keeps shaking his head.
No, I'm shaking it because I think it's funny. It's so good. It's, like, so good. I love it.
And the ghoul gets his hands on the Necronomicon. He opens the book, and what does he see? He sees a spell for a little Beelzebuddy, a little devil friend that he summons.
A devil friend. Gotta love
it. Yes. I don't know, I feel like they just enter, like, a healthy polyamorous relationship and just kind of, like, kiss and make up, and then, you know, it ends with all of them in the house, and it ends on a freeze frame of her dropping a cyanide pill into his morning water cup.
You ended it actually in an interesting way, because normally, for, like, there to be, like, a polyamorous positive relationship, there needs to be some sort of strife, like, there's, like, a dinner scene where they're, like, throwing food at each other, and then they, like, laugh about how funny it is, but what you've actually presented is that there's an illusion of happiness, yeah. Right, that it ends sort of quietly, yeah. But then at the end, you have this sugar baby trying to poison the grave ghoul, the ghoulman, Saul Ghoulman.
Because Saul, the Beelzebuddy, and the sugar baby cannot coexist on the same plane at the same time.
No. No, it's impossible. I really like the character of Saul Ghoulman. I feel like Steve Buscemi would play him really well, but I think you could go a total other opposite route, and you could get, like, someone, like much weirder and much more off the beaten path, like someone who's kind of washed up, maybe. Mm. Actually, you know what you could do? You could dig up Sean Connery's corpse.
Oh, yeah.
And you could just run electrodes through it to make it, like, jerk and spasm, and then have someone do the VO for it.
What's up, bitch? I want my grave bacon.
Can you quick say in his voice, can you say a firm, open-handed slap with the palm? A
firm, open-handed slap with the palm. If you give a shit about people living, go donate to the Trevor Project. Basically protects young LGBTQ+ people from, like, dangerous environments, and, like, helps kids who are in dangerous situations because of that.
No, really. Do donate to that. I mean, like, or you know what? If you don't feel like donating to an organization, just find, like, a scrawny, like, 17-year-old kid who's homeless and just, like, give him $5. Like, that's also good.
Or donate to us, because we for sure donate everything we get.
I will say that do not donate to Walter, because he's just going to funnel it right to the top, right to the Hong Kong League. Slough, thank you for being on the episode.
You want to follow me and get objectively correct facts and opinions, you can follow me at Frog the Scribe on Twitter. Otherwise, keep on wizarding.
I think that's right. Keep on wizarding. Well, we made a movie. We talked about fucking trying to, like, make it through the human experience and, like, latching on to pieces of media to help us cope, which I think is, like, really everything everyone does. And we talked about history. And Slough, you are the most knowledgeable guest on our show so far, and I assume you'll probably continue to be the most knowledgeable guest.
I want to put it out there for everyone. I never graduated from college, so, like, all of my interest in this is purely self. It comes from me.
On that note, remember, if you like this show, to give it a 5-star rating, because we could use it. If you want to reach out to us, either hit us with a tweet at @fakefilmfans, or go ahead and send us an email at fakefilmfans@gmail.com. Remember, if you're going to watch a movie, do it with the lights off.